When the 20th century unfolded in Milwaukee, beer and bowling were hand in hand. The industrial age was taking hold, bringing in lots of working-class German immigrants, and along with the Oompa bands and playing sheepshead, bowling was a natural extension of their European heritage. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking today about the role of bowling in the history of sports and games in Wisconsin and America with Doug Schmidt. Doug's from Milwaukee, generally regarded as Wisconsin's preeminent bowling historian. He's been the editor and publisher of the state's 10-pin journal since 1992 and is the author of the book we'll be talking about. It's titled They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's 10-Pin Capital. It's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press, and we're really pleased to welcome to the phones today. And certainly, if you have a question as we talk about bowling, maybe you've got an experience relating to bowling you want to share. I've had a lot of them myself. I bowled in two leagues back in my youth when I was a pretty good bowler, actually. I bowled two nights a week and carried a pretty hefty average in leagues and always enjoyed it. You may have an experience or maybe a question to share or ask of Doug Schmidt as we move along today, and you're certainly welcome to join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. If you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Doug Schmidt with us by phone. Doug, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, good morning. It's my pleasure to be with you.
Really appreciate having you along. I haven't gotten through your whole book yet, but I've been enjoying reading it. And I was interested right away in the introduction. You mentioned that bowling actually, there's some hint of it all the way back to 5200 BC.
Right. They uncovered some Egyptian artifacts that would indicate that they were like rolling marbles through a certain type of bridge and stuff that was an early remnant of the game that evolved into bowling.
How did it really evolve? I think it went through something. Again, there was a game called Skittles, I believe, but really originated in Germany, did it not?
Right. It started off as kind of a German religious rite. The Christians used to carry a stick with them for protection that they called a kegel. And they would roll stones at it, they'd plant it in the ground, roll stones at it, and if they knocked it over, they were considered to be living exemplary Christian lives. And that term of kegling kind of followed bowling through the ages as it arrived here in Milwaukee.
And it arrived, I assume, with the German immigrants.
Right. When they first settled in New York in the early 1800s, they brought it with them, and it was predominantly a game of nine pins, where the pins were arranged in a diamond formation. And because there was always a gambling element attached to it, bowlers are always looking to make a couple bucks on the side. So the local authorities passed a law prohibiting gambling on the game of nine pins. So to skirt that, they just added another pin made into a triangle, and bowling has been thriving ever since.
Oh my goodness! You know, there always is a little factor of betting when it comes to bowling, isn't there?
Right. Well, I mean, there was a lot of ingenuity in those early days too, when there was no standard size or shape to weight to the ball. Sometimes they would throw a 17-pound or 19-pound ball, and to make it hook, sometimes they would cut one in half and glue a half of a 19-pound ball to a 17-pound ball to make it hook. Or they'd carve it out and put buckshot or lead inside of it and glue it together to make it hook.
Oh, boy. Well, I'll admit to one little bet I got into one night with a guy who carried about a 215 or 217 average, which was better than mine by quite a bit. I challenged him to one game. And so he readily agreed. It was, I think, just for a drink. But I said, I have to set the rules. And he said, okay. Well, he was right-handed, and I was right-handed. And I said, okay, we bowl left-handed.
Oh.
So we we both left-handed, and I think we had each had several gutter balls in a row before.
Well, you have to be careful who you make those bets with. There's a fellow in Milwaukee who was ambidextrous, and he's had 800s with bowling right-handed and left-handed.
Oh, well, I wouldn't want to bet with him. That's for sure. Well, I tell you what, let's go back to bowling's really got started, really got going in Milwaukee and professional bowling and everything else. 1905, wasn't it, a Milwaukee bowling alley proprietor?
Well, Abe Langtree, he was born 8 years after President Lincoln was assassinated, and obviously that had an impact on his parents, who named him Abraham Lincoln Langtree. And he caught on with the game early. He had 24 lanes in a three-story office building in downtown Milwaukee at the start of the century. And because he was recognized as the most successful proprietor in the Midwest at that time, he lobbied the American Bowling Congress, headquartered in New York at that time, to bring the national tournament to Milwaukee, along with we had an infamous mayor back then in Milwaukee named David Rose, who believed in having a wide-open town. So anything went in Milwaukee, and they awarded Milwaukee a tournament in 1905, and it kind of sacked an attendance record. But 2 years later, Abe Langtree was named Secretary of the American Bowling Congress, and he wound up serving in that capacity for 25 years. And that's how Milwaukee became the home of the national headquarters, because it never left here after he took office and the organization kept growing.
Was he kind of a character?
Well, he was a very straight, he was a tall gentleman, probably about 6'4", very straightforward guy, kind of a no-nonsense person that really is what the game needed, you know, to lobbied to get the standardized weight of the ball, a balanced ball, made, and was instrumental in a lot of the early rules that standardized the game. And he just was not, you know, he was against gambling and everything like that. He used to walk the aisles at the national tournaments watching to see if guys were making side bets and stuff to police the tournament himself.
Well, bowling back then is quite a bit different than it is now. I had an uncle who set pins in an alley. He was a big guy, and he got pretty strong doing that.
Sure, and yeah, that was a lot. That was the way a lot of the early bowlers got started, working in a place that they had to have manual pin setters. One of the interesting stories I traced in the book was a family in Milwaukee where the father had about four lanes attached to his tavern, and he used to pay the boys in the neighborhood 5 cents a line to set pins for the leagues. And one night, the leagues were ready to start, and the pin setters walked out. They were all standing outside. So he asked his son, he says, "How come the pin setters aren't working?" And he says, "Well, they're on strike. They want a raise." So he gave them a penny raise, and then he went back to work for 6 cents a line.
6 cents a line.
Yeah.
That's a great story. You have a lot of kind of neat little stories under sort of a little subheads. One is It Really Happened, that I liked a lot, which skips ahead, but Carl Lohr, who you might tell that's these are little side stories within the history of the of bowling that you have in your book.
Right, Carl Lohr. I happen to know him personally, so he probably never thought that he'd ever make a bowling history book. But one night he was so anxious to get to the bar afterwards that he packed up his ball and went to the bar, had a few drinks. When he got home, he changed shoes. And when he came back the next week, he changed shoes again, and he started sticking at the foul line. Well, what had happened, because his bowling shoes were sneaker style, he had not switched shoes when he got done the previous week, so he put his street shoes on when he returned to bowling, and he was sticking at the foul line.
So he ran around with his bowling shoes.
Right.
Wearing his... I got a big laugh when I read that.
His friend, he couldn't see. He was like, "I can't figure out why I'm sticking so bad." His friend looked at him and says, "Well, you've got your street shoes on."
Oh, that was a great story. Well, we have some callers online, so let's go to Jerry in Tomahawk. Jerry, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, how are you doing down there?
Great.
I'm 84-year-old goat now.
84.
Today, I turned on the radio and you were talking about this bowling thing, and it sure takes me back to when I used to be in a pit and set lines for a nickel line. Certain the pins, you know.
Yep.
Now they got them pin spotters, you know. But in our days, we were in the pit there and watch your legs, and we used to set the pins, you know.
Right, yeah. That's I mentioned that in the book, that that was kind of the standard fee, about 5 cents a game to jump out of the way and keep those pins set.
Sure.
And a lot of times I know bowlers, when they get done with league, they would throw a nickel or a dime or a sandwich down the slide it down the gutter to keep the pin setter there so they could bowl pot games afterwards.
And then after a while, then I went to Detroit from the East Coast, and I met some. I played with some of the best: Eddie Lubansky, Burris Fazio, Ned Day, Carter. That was my time at bowling.
Right. Yeah, those were a lot of great names in the annals of bowling history. And of course, I'm particularly fond of Ned Day because he came to Milwaukee from Los Angeles and honed his skills here, and teamed up with Hank Marino to create one of the strongest teams of all time, the Heil Products team in the 1930s. And they performed in as an exhibition sport in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin.
Yep, that's quite a while ago. Oh, 300 them days there, when you made 300, you earn it, you know. It was something else. I brought back some memories when I used to set pins.
Well, I tell you what, Jerry, I thank you very much for calling. I'm 84 years old and a pin setter. Pin setters, you got a little workout when you were a pin setter, didn't you, Doug?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I can't imagine what it's like having to jump out of the way when those pins start flying, and you're trying to stay up above the pin deck to avoid getting hit, and never knowing if someone's going to throw a ball while you're still setting the pins or something, too.
And I'm trying to remember how much a pin weighed.
Let's see. Well, they standardized them.
Yeah.
I should know that.
I can't remember. I mean, there's a little weight to them. They're not just balsa wood.
Yeah, there's supposed to be between 3 pounds, 6 ounces, and I think the maximum would be like 3.8 or 4 pounds.
Yeah, so your 3 to 4 pounder, and you got 10 of them there, and you're picking those up and setting them in every time. Why, you got a pretty good workout by the end of the night.
It definitely would keep you in shape, right?
Yeah, no kidding. Thanks, Jerry. Roger in Hartford, we'll go to you next. Hi, Roger.
Yes, good morning. I used to be an avid bowler, and I still like to watch bowling and read about bowling, but the Milwaukee Journal never covers the professional bowlers tour unless it's in Milwaukee. I was just curious why that is, you know, because there's a lot of bowlers in the area yet, and Milwaukee was once known for the bowling capital of the world, but, you know, since then there hasn't been much coverage in the Journal and Sentinel, other than the Pro Bowlers Tour when it comes to Milwaukee. I was just wondering how come.
Well, yeah, during the heyday, the glory days, the Journal had a sports writer named Billy 60, and he covered bowling and golf for about 60 years for them until he retired in the 1970s. And after that, well, you get a change of sports editors, and if they don't have a strong Milwaukee connection, I guess they just don't. There are some that just don't feel that Milwaukee is or that bowling is a real true sport or something, and they're just not inclined to want to give it the recognition that it deserves. There were, even with the Masters tournament being held here last month, they were competing for $100,000, and their bowling writer, his stories wound up appearing on page 8 and page 9 of the sports section.
Yeah,
so it's a tough nut to crack. But that seems to be, I don't know. There are so many sports nowadays, too, that there was a lot less competition back then.
Yeah.
Bowling was the thing. Teams used to travel around the country bowling for match game titles. And so that was always garner headlines on the front page of the papers, even.
Yeah.
And there's just, you know, now you have basketball and football. And, of course, in Wisconsin, everybody goes crazy over the Packers or the Badgers and stuff, too. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Only time you get any results is you have to go on the internet to get them, and a lot of people don't have access to it, you know. And I just think it's a shame because they still have some bowling scores in for some of the leagues, but it's a shame that the PBA isn't covered. And I just thought I'd see what you can do about it. I thank you much for your input.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We're visiting with Doug Schmidt of Milwaukee today. He is generally regarded as Wisconsin's preeminent bowling historian, and he's written the book They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's Ten-Pin Capital. It's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Really pleased to have him with us today. And you can join in, too, if you have a question or a comment about bowling, maybe an experience to share. There were a lot of great experiences that I remember and some I'd like to forget. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller, our preeminent bowler at Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Doug Schmidt about his book, They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's Ten-Pin Capital, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Really pleased to have him along. Give us a call if you have a question at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And before we go back to the phones, and we'll get to Dennis in just a minute here, Doug, but in your book, in 1920, you note that Frank Smith arrived in Milwaukee from Cleveland with a kind of a grand vision in mind. What, and you tell that story. What did he open at 2nd and Wisconsin?
Well, he took over the lower level of the Plankington building downtown, and he installed 41 lanes down there. There was it was a phenomenal arcade. There was a rifle range and billiard room and all that. But the 41 lanes was really kind of the biggest, grandest display of bowling that the area had seen in, you know, since the bowling had started to become popular. So he was quite a showman. You know, he wasn't afraid to spend his money and do whatever he could to promote the game. He even brought in Jimmy Smith, who was a renowned bowler from the East Coast, to provide instructions and do exhibition matches and stuff. And so he had him, and that's why Wisconsin Avenue in downtown Milwaukee was actually the birthplace of bowling, because he had the Plankington Arcade, and then Hank Marino came up from Chicago and had 16 lanes in the bottom of the Carpenter Building around 6th and Wisconsin. And, of course, then by then, well, Abe Langtree had started to fade out of the scene by 1930. And there were a lot of fraternal organizations, too, like the Elks Club and Moose Lodge, all had bowling alleys in their buildings downtown. All the way out to almost 27th in Wisconsin, where the Eagles Club was located.
And early on, a lot of those lanes were, or a lot of those alleys were, you know, maybe 4, 6, 8, 10 lanes.
Right, right. That was the general size of bowling centers. And in Milwaukee, well, it was became part of the Industrial Revolution, where, you know, the neighborhoods grew up. A lot of the Polish and German immigrants settled in Milwaukee to work factory jobs, take the streetcars and the buses to work, and on the way home they'd stop at the tavern for a few brews. And wherever the tavern keepers had space, they would usually attach 2 to 4 lanes. So that's why you wound up with a lot of small bowling venues throughout the city. And you could, you know, every couple blocks you could go and find a place that had some bowling lanes.
Yep.
It also affected, too, when a minority started moving up, gravitating here. As I have a chapter on that about breaking down barriers. Blacks, that African-Americans that came up from Mississippi and Alabama looking for industrial jobs in the 50s and 60s, they settled in these neighborhoods. A lot of them had never been exposed to bowling, but wherever they went, someone would introduce them to bowling, and they found a whole new sport and became very active in the sport themselves to this day.
Good stories in there in that chapter. Dennis and Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. Doug. My grandfather, Joe Feldhausen, at one point was a professional bowler, and my dad used to be a pin boy, and he used to talk about when the balls came in, trying to avoid all the pins coming up and all the bruises he'd come home with after a stint setting pins. But I wanted to ask a question. How come the Bowlers Hall of Fame is in St. Louis instead of Milwaukee? Thank you.
Well, that's an interesting dilemma. It originally, when they opened a new ABC, WIBC headquarters in Greendale, they did have one wing devoted to the Bowling Hall of Fame and Museum. But after a few years, they realized that there wasn't enough space to handle all their offices and all the artifacts to do justice to a Hall of Fame. Consequently, St. Louis made a bid, and they built a whole new structure down there, which was across from Busch Stadium. And since somewhere in the 1980s, that building opened, and all the bowling history went down there. There is some debate now of what's going to happen. There are some changes taking place in that St. Louis location. So if someone, philanthropist, would step forward, they might be able to have funding to build a new place, maybe bring it back to Milwaukee.
Bring it back to Milwaukee. No. Thanks, Dennis. Paul in Menominee, it's your turn next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I missed the first part of the program, but I have a couple pin sitter. I worked as a pin sitter all in the 50s, and we would get people that were drinking, and so they would pick up a ball right away after they'd thrown their first ball, forgetting that the pin sitter was down there trying to pick up pins. Or you'd get people would try on purpose to hit the pin sitter. And so we had a couple of things we would do. If we thought the person wasn't being malicious, we would put backspin on the ball when we return it, and it wouldn't make it up the ramp. Then they had to walk down the length of the alley to retrieve the ball.
Sounds like a good strategy.
if we knew they were being malicious, if they were young guys who were just trying to get the pin sitter, then we would spit in the thumb hole.
Oh.
And they go to throw the ball, it would slip off and drop on his foot.
Well, those are great stories, Paul.
Well, as a matter of fact, I've heard of other stories of kind of creative, too, for ways of meeting someone that you want to get acquainted with, someone from the opposite sex or something. A proprietor mentioned to me that they used to put, they'd have someone in the back in the pits there, they'd write a little note, say, so-and-so on lane 16 is interested in you or something like that, stick it in a thumb hole and it rolled back, and a gal would pick up her ball and find this note in there, and they'd get to meet people that way.
We would do that.
You'd do that too, Paul. Oh.
Yeah, you'd put the thumb hole so it would rotate on the axis, it would be at the pole, and so the note wouldn't fall out until it got up, and then they'd see the note. And...
Well, did you ever have any luck with that?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
People would respond, yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Paul.
Thank
great
you.
Stories.
Bowling is a great socializing sport.
Yeah, it is that. JT in La Crosse, we'll go to you next. Hi, JT.
Hi. My question is, how many 300 games have been bowled in a row at one time?
By one person.
Over a period of time. Yeah, by one person.
All right.
I don't know of any record other than, the 900 series that have ever been sanctioned.
Been 900 series.
Oh, definitely. We've had three in Milwaukee just in the last, since 1998. Two of them last year, as a matter of fact, the two 900 series.
And for those who aren't familiar, that's three perfect games.
36 consecutive strikes. Right?
36 consecutive strikes over three games, and that's the typical, that's a league. When you bowl in a league, you bowl three games.
Generally, right. Even in, as far as tournaments, that's still been the record that I know of is 36 consecutive strikes that have been sanctioned.
And there were probably, people who bowled several, hit some more strikes after that, but those were never recorded. 900 is kind of the gold standard, I guess.
Right. There have been in the country now since they started sanctioning more, there have been about... I'm starting to lose track. There have been 12 or 15 sanctioned 900 series across the country now.
Oh. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, JT. Appreciate it. Talking with Doug Schmidt about his book that's out this year, They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's 10-Pin Capital. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, give us a call at 263-1890, 263-1890. If you got a story to share or a question to ask, we would love to hear from you. By 19, 35, you write in your book, Doug, Milwaukee had 200 sanctioned leagues, and that's the greatest number of bowlers per capita than anywhere in the country.
Right. Milwaukee never had the population figures. Milwaukee at that time had about 600 and roughly around 600,000 residents, whereas Chicago had 3.5 million population. So, you know, cities like that obviously had more bowlers, but no city was ever as bowling crazed as Milwaukee was for the number of people that participated. And that was men and women. You know, the women had their own, had formed their own national organization by 1916. So they, I mean, in the early days, the women would, it wasn't the bowling place, wasn't where ladies would hang out. It was considered, so if they wanted to get out and bowl during the day, sometimes the proprietor would put up a bed sheet to separate the lanes from the bar so that the women could bowl. And that's kind of where the term coffee clutch evolved from. I don't know if you heard that term before.
Yeah, well, sure.
The coffee clutch leagues. I was interested in how that originated, and of course, it was always KK leagues, and I've written about a lot of them over the years, and I was openings in the KK leagues. Well, that was in German, coffee starts with a K, and klatsch starts with a K, and klatsch means gossip. So women's early women's leagues was all about, you know, having some Danish and some coffee and gossip and bowling a few lines. And it evolved from there into the coffee klatsch leagues.
At that time, around 1930 or by 1935, that was one in five adults in Milwaukee were bowlers. That's amazing. 20% of the adult population of Milwaukee bowled. That's an amazing figure.
Yeah, and that, you know, and it was because of that that German influence that we had at least a dozen churches that had bowling lanes in their basements and stuff too, and that was predominantly the Lutheran church congregations that had the lanes, too, because it was part of their German heritage.
Yeah. Alexis in Monona, we'll turn to you next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I really hate to change the subject back to the social aspect, but first of all, my mom, I'm in my mid-40s, and my mother came from Louisiana, and when she moved to our neighborhood that we lived in, joined the bowling league. And I can remember going as a toddler to daycare at the bowling league while my mom had her coffee clutch gang, and their team was named the Cellar Dwellers. But my older sister was a big-time bowler in Milwaukee, and she and her husband were actually engaged at a bowling alley on New Year's Eve. How about that?
Oh, that's a great story.
Yep. They've been married 20 years. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Alexis, for calling. You get a few stories like that.
It shows again that bowling is a great way for socializing and getting to know people.
Yeah, it is that.
I think you know, one of the interesting stories about endurance occurred during the Depression. It was one of my favorite ones to uncover. It was at in the basement of the hotel, Antlers Hotel downtown, where the manager decided to have a little bowling marathon. He put up $80 as a prize. And he figured, well, if they start Sunday morning, by Sunday evening, they'll all be wore out and it'll be over. Well, he drew about a dozen bowlers, and they kept on bowling, and a lot of them dropped out. But by Sunday night, there were two of them that refused to quit. And they bowled on through Sunday night, through Monday. And the one was going to quit. He was from Beaver Dam, but he was getting telegrams, and they were urging him on to keep going. And they bowled a total of 56 hours and 362 games, I believe.
Oh.
They bowled from Sunday morning through Tuesday morning.
So did the Beaver Dam guy finally win?
No, he finally conceded to a tannery worker from downtown Milwaukee.
Oh, man.
But, of course, $80 during the Depression was a lot of money. It was worth over $1,100. So.
Yeah.
But that's still a lot of endurance. They couldn't even sit down between games. They got like a 10-minute break every hour or so.
Wow. That's a great story. Chris in Glendale is online, so let's go to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi. There's a certain look to bowling alleys that I enjoy. And as you know, in architecture, there's a formal name for different styles of architecture. You know, there's Bauhaus, the international style, and so forth. The name, the school of thought in architecture that encompasses a certain era of bowling alleys is actually called Googie, G-O-O-G-I-E. And an architect named Alan Hess wrote a book full of photographs of the Googie style. And the Googie style is not limited to bowling alleys. It also encompasses a certain era of coffee shops and other forms. The Seattle Space Needle is also an example of Googie. And the visual look of it has certain components. There's something that's light and not serious about it, and there's a kind of a weightless quality and often a mixture of dissimilar shapes. And once you become sensitive to this, you start seeing this, sadly, in the form of decaying buildings. I've photographed a couple of bowling alleys, and I do see the Googie look in there. This actually sounds like a prank or something that's not true, but I would encourage any listeners, do a keyword search for the word Googie, and you'll find the book, and you'll find a couple of websites dedicated to this. And by the way, Googie also describes the signage in Las Vegas in the early 60s and late 50s. Well, really early 60s. There's a certain kind of sign with neon and actual light bulbs. And that, too, spills over into the bowling alley look of the building and the signage. And the remaining Googie structures, and I'm referring to buildings and signage, they're slowly being demolished. But here and there I'll see a bowling alley with a particular Googie look to it. The word Googie actually is in architecture as an established term. And it's something that a snob from the architecture world would never discuss, or even some of. I occasionally run into people who are high minded, and purport to know a bit about architecture, and they don't know the word Googie. It seems to be kind of the little area that's a little too popular of architecture.
That's interesting. Did you know about that, Doug?
No, that's a new term for me. I'll definitely have to do some word search on that.
I did. I actually went online, and there's some interesting pieces and some great photos when you look under Googie. Thanks a lot, Chris. I appreciate you sharing that with us. I want to give some others a chance to get on here, so I'm going to move on to Ralph in Genoa City. Ralph, hello to you.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was reading in the Sentinel the other day that somebody in downtown Milwaukee, and it kind of excited me, was going to be putting in this complex with 41 bowling lanes and a real high-tech thing, and they had a little bit of a picture of it, and they were doing that in other cities, too. It was kind of neat. I don't know if you saw that or not.
Doug, did you see that?
In downtown Milwaukee? This was in the Journal Sentinel?
Yeah.
I wasn't aware of that. I know the latest thing that was developed was in a Bayshore shopping mall where they've gone all towards the upper end. It's kind of almost like a martini bar, and it's not even geared towards league bowling, but it's very upscale, a whole different avenue and taking bowling to a different mass appeal to different type of crowd and stuff.
Well, Ralph, maybe somebody else knows about that. We'll check. Thanks for calling. Vern in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Vern.
Hi. I started setting pins in 1949, and my uncle used to set pins, and I watched him. He came back there when I was a little kid. So I started when they first started making the racks, and I was only 13, and my friend was 14. He was a little bit bigger than I, but there was a labor thing that we got worried about. We had eight lanes and went on. It was upstairs, and the pool hall was downstairs. So because we would both set in one alley together, we could keep up. And then later on, then we would take two lanes and even get down the line. I would go downstairs and shoot pool while he'd set my lane. then I'd go upstairs, he'd go downstairs, and we'd go down the fire escape and keep. That's how I got to set in two lanes at a time.
That's a great story.
Well, if anyone wants to set pins in Milwaukee, we still have the Holler House available. That's the oldest certified lanes, you know, in the country, well, second oldest behind the Elks Lodge and the Fond du Lac, but they have two alleys in the basement there below the bar room. And if you want to bowl there, you have to call ahead to make sure that they have a pin setter lined up. I'm actually going to be doing a book signing there on next Tuesday evening.
Yeah, to talk about this. You've got some book signings, and tell us again where you're going to be at. Where's...
Well, the Holler House, for anyone that's familiar with Milwaukee, is located at 20th and Lincoln. It's a bar right on the corner there, and then you have to go through the side door to get downstairs to the bowling lanes, and they do have leagues there three or four times a week. And
when are you going to be there?
Tuesday, December 4th.
Tuesday, December 4th, okay.
And then I will be coming to Madison on January 15th for that History Sandwich Dinner Program. I'll be there during a lunch period at the museum.
Oh, great. At the Historical Society.
Right.
Well, that's great. I tell you what, we're having a lot of fun. What your favorite remembrance from the history that you've covered here?
Well, there are several. One of them that I enjoyed most was all the years I had the opportunity to cover the Miller High Life Open, from the Professional Bowling Association days, doing that firsthand and watching 1978 when our local boy from Greendale, Fred Jasky, wound up winning the title against Marshall Holman, who was making a real surge to try to catch him, and the fans were booing Marshall all through the week and cheering Fred, and it almost got too much for Marshall to take. And I thought he averaged like 235 his first three matches on TV and then lost to Fred in the finals. It was quite an event that year.
And bowling alleys have changed. We were talking about the Googie style of bowling, the bowling alleys themselves, or how they market the bowling alleys, has changed quite a bit. You see strobe lights and everything else now in some of the centers.
Right. Yeah. You see companies like Brunswick who have really taken a lead, and there are other companies too that. Creating a whole new atmosphere as an entertainment center with you have Glow and Bowl, and kids like to go there, and they have karaoke music and flashing lights and stuff, and it's a great recreational opportunity for the youth bowlers too to get reacquainted with the sport.
Well,
along with high school bowling is also growing.
Oh, it is. I didn't know that.
Right. Yeah, Wisconsin is on the cusp of having it as a letter sport. There are several states now that have added bowling as a letter sport, so it's gaining recognition because it offers an opportunity for kids that can't normally compete in other sports to, you know, participate in a letter sport that doesn't require certain size or skill.
Right. Some of the best bowlers were pretty were not very large people. You want to.
They come in all sizes.
They come in all sizes. Doug, and I tell you what, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Thanks a lot for being with us. Doug Schmidt is, as I mentioned earlier, from Milwaukee, generally regarded as Wisconsin's preeminent bowling historian, and he's written the book, They Came to Bowl, How Milwaukee Became America's Ten-Pin Capital. Great history of the sport of bowling, and... if you bowl or had a parent but bowled, or I tell you what, even without bowling, it's kind of interesting. Even if you don't bowl, it's interesting to read How Milwaukee Became America's Ten-Pin Capital. And it's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press, so it should be available in any of your bookstores, I'm sure. You can certainly order them. Thanks again to Doug Schmidt. Coming up, we're going to be talking with a zany gourmet, Mr. Mustard, Barry Levinson, next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.